This is day five of this November 2015 seven-day session. Do one more day on the teachings of the 16th century Chinese Zen master Zibo. And the name of the book is Zibo, the Last Great Zen Master of China, translated by J.C. Cleary. This translator gives this segment the name Adaptable Compassion. And Zibo begins, generally people pay back their parents' virtue by making offerings of food on prescribed occasions. So it's really their deceased parents. This is part of it's considered in China filial piety, part of the rites that you would do. People pay back their deceased parents' virtue by making offerings of food on prescribed occasions. But they are only increasing their dark karma. Worldly conventional people are benighted and blind. It is always hard to explain the true principle to them. Got to work a little here to see why this conventional ritual in China, it's been happening for millennia, why he would describe this as only increasing their dark karma. Suppose if you saw it as still mired in the idea of self and other, then you're not getting beyond that. Don't know. But this statement, worldly conventional people are benighted and blind, is always hard to explain the true principle to them. On one of my pilgrimages to China, it dawned on me that these Buddhists, these Chinese Buddhists that would flock to some of the temples, really had wasn't the purest intention of their doing this. I can't be sure, of course, but based on everything I've read, a strong element of self-interest in doing this, there would always be stores near these temples where you could buy these little bundles of incense, big, thick, long sticks of incense, inexpensive incense, and they would somehow light these all at once, the ends of this one of these bundles, and the temples, the outside of the temples, definitely, sometimes the inside would be just clouds of incense smoke. It's very hard to know the motivation of others, but unless they were enlightened, there would be an element of self in there, of acquiring merit in doing that. In other words, if so, then they wouldn't have known the true principle that there is no giver, there is no one to give to, and there is no giving in the ultimate sense. These are called the three wheels, the emptiness of the three wheels. In all things, there is no self, there is no object of the action. Let's say, raking leaves. There's no raker, there are no leaves to be raked, and then therefore, if there's neither subject nor object, there is no raking. This will sound just incomprehensible to a lot of people, but it's true. There is no self to the raker or to the leaves. Everything is evanescent. Everything is just energy in flux. Nothing we can call substantial. There's no it to those leaves, because as soon as we say it, they've changed in some way that isn't even visible to us. The same with the doer, and therefore the doing itself. This is just a dry explanation for what we all have to realize through our own direct experience of awakening. And then he takes off on this topic of ritual. Ritual without the understanding of the essential nature of the ritual, that is, without understanding the emptiness of it. He says, temporarily going along with their customs and practices to make them happy, the sage worthies realize that their habits are not easily changed. Provisionally floating and sinking along with them, the sages use inner truth to cut away their sentiments, working in the shadows, secretly taming and tempering them. After long effort, the power is sufficient and their habits change by themselves. Those who are undergoing the tempering are oblivious to why it is so. Thus the sages share the vicissitudes of social forms. If they didn't rejoice at what the conventional people celebrate, if they didn't offer condolences when the conventional people mourn, this would mean bitter feelings against the sages. I think of an old saying that a wise missionary allows the natives to keep their idols under the bed. It takes time to let go of one's notions, one's attachments, and if one is feeling forced to do that, then it could be unskillful on the part of whoever's trying to help the person change. This is part of the discernment that is called for by teachers or leaders, to know what people are ready for. To find the right timing of things. In the early 70s, at the center at Arnold Park, there'd be a Christmas tree installed in the link at the center during the holidays season. And at the time when I was still attached to Christmas, I have a lot of happy memories of Christmas. It was a relief to know that, and I thought it was very nice that Roshi Kaplow would bend like this and have us acknowledge the conventional, what's he call it here, the conventional forms, and all. And then I think it's fair to say that we just outgrew it as a sangha. We outgrew that and didn't need to do that anymore. And we have our Thanksgiving celebration. There's no there's no concession there. There's no compromise, because Thanksgiving is an exquisitely Buddhist in spirit. Thanking, acknowledging this endless knot of interconnectedness, and finding a way to commemorate, to express the many, many beings we can be grateful to. I think too of our children's Jukai, although I think it makes sense for children of a certain age to take these precepts. When they're too young, they don't have the moral development to really know what they're doing. But still, we include them in the faith that they'll, it's more than the precepts that they're soaking up in a children's Jukai. They're, everything associated with it, if it's done nicely, they're going to have positive memories, associations, the whole spirit of reverence and respect. These things they will absorb in their little bones, and it creates a favorable karmic affinity with the Dharma, even though the precepts themselves are maybe beyond them at a very young age. Next is called the process of delusion. When habitual practices are deep-rooted, they are hard to remold, even with heaven and earth as the furnace, yin and yang as the fuel, a whirlwind for a bellows, and the creator's power. Which creator would he be referring to there? Thus, the Buddha used the water of emptiness to wash them away. The water of emptiness, that is the realization, when it finally comes to one, the realization that these habits of ours, the habit energy, what we call karma, is essentially empty. There's no, certainly there are no roots to it. It's energy, it's habitual energy, it's ways that we have reacted to people and to situations so many times that it's worn a kind of a groove in our body-mind complex, but still, there's nothing to them. There's nothing to this, there's no thingness to the energy. And it's seeing the formlessness of form, seeing the formlessness of our habit forces, which start with our thoughts. Seeing the formlessness of our thoughts is where we can transform our whole understanding. But until then, and even after then, these habit forces have a life of their own. Elsewhere in this book, I'm flipping back here, he has a nice analogy here. He says, the knowing subject is hard to smash because habits have gelled into second nature. It is like oil put into flour. Unless you can penetrate through to fundamental mind and use the luminous, selfless one to deal with habits, the oil will never be taken out of the flour. You could say that seshin and practice more broadly is a process of waking up to these habit forces in ourselves, seeing with ever greater clarity, ever greater sobering clarity, how deeply habituated we are to our ways of thinking and acting and reacting. We keep exposing more subtle layers of this. We may think at some point that we're onto ourselves. We've gotten the gist of our particular karmic vulnerabilities, and then we see still more subtle ones that we have been blind to. Of course, we don't have to rid ourselves of these to awaken to our true nature. But the more of it we can see, the more we become aware of, the more effectively we can deal with them, which means not getting snared in them, seeing them for what they are. Nothing. And so, when they're deep-rooted, and we all have our particular deep-rooted ones, they are hard to remold, even with heaven and earth as the furnace. Thus, the Buddha used the water of emptiness to wash them away. In effect, wash them away. Because once you've seen that there's nothing to them, then your relationship to them changes. It's like, as Hakuin says, and when we recite the Hakuin chant, our form now being no form, and going and returning, we never leave home. Our thoughts now being no thoughts, our dancing and songs are the voice of the Dharma. And he talks about the problem with delusive emotions. Little do people realize that before anger and joy arise, they are the same as the Buddhas and ancestral teachers. If they, and by the way, whenever they, in these old Chinese texts, when they talk about joy, I feel obliged to mention that this is not a grounded joy that is lasting. It's not the kind of joy they're talking about. They're talking about the flights of a giddy kind of joy, like winning the lottery, or to exaggerate, a joy that comes and goes, and that can wreak havoc if we get attached to it. He's not talking about this deep, quiet, centered joy that steadily grows through long practice. Little people realize that before anger and joy arise, they are the same as the Buddhas and ancestral teachers. If they go wrong with anger, they become asuras. Here he works his way through the six realms of unenlightened existence. Asuras are the fourth one up, I think. The fight, sometimes called the fighting demons, fighting spirits. So if they go wrong with anger, they become asuras. If they go wrong with ignorance, they become animals. If they go wrong with greed, they become hungry ghosts. If they go wrong with evil, they become hell beings. Devas and humans are so by means of the 10 virtues and the 5 precepts. These are the so-called 6 realms. He singles out devas and humans, the heavenly beings and humans, These are considered the two highest of the six realms of unenlightened existence, and we've earned our way to these states, the Deva realm and the human realm, because of our if not mastery of the precepts and the ten virtues, at least our earnest work in the past on these. I hope people can not get hung up on this old terminology about hungry ghosts and animals and so forth. What is this? Yeah, the 16th century, all over the world, there was this primitive way of understanding these forces, or in this case, these aspects of human consciousness and behavior. And so they settled into, in Buddhism, they settled into these descriptions of states of lower than the human state. Asuras, these fighting spirits, I just see them as people. Let's just stick to people for now. People whose whole paradigm in their lives is power, and struggle and competition. If you're not on top, then you're underneath. Animals are those who are dominated by primitive reactions, fear, and predation. Hungry ghosts are those who are, as he says, are dominated by avarice, addictive states. Hell speaks for itself. Hakuin, in his writings, in describing some of the trials and tribulations he went through in his youth, of being battered by emotional states, severe emotional states. He refers to them as being struck down by some unknown demon. So now we have psychological terms for these disorders, but it's the same. And then he says, nevertheless, a deva who does not awaken can become a human, that is, can sink down a rung to the human realm. A human who does not awaken can become an animal. With such a multitude of faults, it would be impossible for them to return to their true state without using the water of emptiness to wash them away. This is the very sobering fact of our pre-enlightenment state, is that we can, just as we can evolve through these states, we can evolve from a hellish state of existence upward, we can also devolve. See this all the time in the world around us. People who reach some kind of success or celebrity and then plummet into some state of suffering. Often it's you can see the causes. There's self-destructiveness on their part, but sometimes we don't. It's just being assassinations or other things like this. Moreover, there are three kinds of not awakening. Confusion due to views and thoughts, confusion due to the multiplicity of sense objects, and fundamental ignorance. I'm trying to put this in terms, these three in terms I'm more familiar with. Fundamental ignorance is what in Asia is called avidya. This means just not knowing the way things are, not knowing the true nature of things. The other two, the two confusions he mentions, would be maybe two different kinds of delusion. Delusion because of our notions about things, our views and thoughts, and confusion that we get into because of when we're facing the different challenges of our sense pleasures and our attachments to the senses. He says, all with blood and breath are guilty of these three. That's why they do not attain to the path of the sages. They do not penetrate to inner truth. They do not fuse phenomena. And they do not get the subtle wonder of the path. Fuse phenomena, I would take as they don't see that fundamentally all phenomena are one mind, one in their true nature, that they have different appearances, different forms, and for that we give them different names, different words, but underneath all that, all those differences, there is just this one reality, indivisible. We in truth, phenomena don't need to be fused. They already are. But until we see that, then we can come to see it by getting into deep concentration, samadhi. That's when the fundamental indivisibility of phenomena is revealed. If they penetrated inner truth, they would comprehend wherever they go. With fusion, no phenomena could obstruct them. We people today have a tremendous accumulation of good and evil. The mountain of self and others is high. When things go against us, we are angered and displeased. When joy and anger are born, the substratum of luminous awareness is obscured. Notice, not forfeited, not lost, just obscured. Once this pedestal of awareness is obscured, when we see form, we are deluded by form, and when we hear sounds, we are deluded by sounds. That is, we become attached to them as separate from us, separate from one another. Fragrant and foul, sweet and bitter, rough and smooth, the shadows of likes and dislikes, these are all forms of knowledge generated from sense objects. Since the knowledge is diluted, it goes wrong. Going wrong, it moves away from reality. The one round light is fragmented into the six consciousnesses. Once it becomes discriminating consciousness, it judges the body to be the self. Deluded by sexual attraction, increased by desires for food and drink, the waves of sentiment flood out, washing you along into impermanence. This creates all sorts of evil manifestations in the skull's cave of false imaginations. The sky cannot cover them, the earth cannot bear them up. Tied up in the dark for eternal ages, changing physical shape, that's probably an allusion to rebirth, rising and sinking through myriad forms, the bitter suffering is indescribable. people are bitten by mosquitoes, they squirm around and are not at peace. If they hear of this suffering and their minds remain unmoved, can they be called the most luminous of beings? This next stone is about dreaming. If there is actually no self when you sleep without dreaming, who controls the breathing? If you think there is a self, where is it? Without knowing how, you dream. Suddenly you don't know where you are. Who controls the breathing when we're in deep sleep? If you think there's a self, where is it? You must be mindful that old age and sickness do not give us a fixed amount of time. In other words, we don't know how much longer we have. Time should not be frivolously wasted. When you gain success and fame, it is no different from wearing a garland of flowers in a dream. I'm guessing that he's writing to someone who he knows aspires to success and fame. Or maybe has already reached success and fame. When you gain success and fame, it is no different from wearing a garland of flowers in a dream. When you lose success and fame, it is no different than the flowers which you wear in the dream being blown down by the wind. Moved by the vanishing of the flowers, you awaken. Upon awakening, you think back on wearing the garland of flowers in the dream. The flowers in the dream vanish. When you awaken, who was wearing them? What vanished? Who is it who wakes up and knows of the flowers and the vanishing? Thus you come to investigate this. Before the self is there, where does the self suddenly come from? Once the self is there, it cannot turn things around, but in the end is turned around by them. Ultimately, where is the root of this sickness? If you can find the root of the sickness, then everything is all right. Wearing flowers, flowers vanishing, vain thoughts with eyes open, dreaming with eyes closed, not dreaming with eyes closed. Human beings do not know how to make themselves important and make themselves great. Thus, there are no lengths of evil they won't go to. Since they do not make themselves important, things become important, and their own state of being becomes unimportant. Since they do not make themselves great, things become great, and their own selves become minor. Thus, they lose their importance and greatness and accept instead the trivial and the minor without refusing them. To to make ourselves important or make ourselves great is to realize the true self, this one, to realize the master, as Basui would have said with his natural koan, who is the master, to realize our illimitability, our vastness, and he says, since they do not realize this self nature, then things acquire all of this importance and become attached to things and driven by things. Things are things because of mind. All inherently possess the full measure of this importance and this greatness, no matter whether old or young, worthy or foolish. It is just that they are swindled and led astray by insignificant reputation and petty profit, superficial glory, and insubstantial social status. The fundamental light of each and every person shines through past, present, and future. He's really talking, isn't he, about this deep insecurity that drives people to grasp at these extrinsic goals, becoming someone, a big shot, looking for anything to aggrandize this self. I have some words here from Yasutani Roshi about this, things are things because of mind. One's environment or circumstances of one's life are a reflection of one's mind. It's like an echo which reverberates according to the sound of our voice. Instead of trying to change our environment when we are unhappy, we need to change ourselves, since our environment is the reflection of ourselves. There is nothing beyond one's consciousness. To think otherwise is to live in a dream world. Goes on, alas, the eyes are entangled by form, the ears are entangled by sound, and so on. The mind is entangled by the seven sentiments, joy, anger, sadness, fear, love, hate, and craving, and the five desires. Still, people say, my whole life I have been happy and without entanglements. Little do they realize that the one, quote, without entanglements, has been entangled for a long time already. In sum, this is because the desires of ordinary people are strong and their spirits befuddled. They persist in their faults, unaware of them. The ordinary person is like a drunkard lying in a mud puddle. Someone arouses him and says, "This mud puddle is no place to be lying down in." The drunkard glares angrily and says, "I have never drunk alcohol. Why do you slander me?" Oh, I could do better than that, but I'd rather not go back there. These days, the whole world suffers from the drunkard's illness. How can I find one who isn't drunk to talk with? Again, the fundamental ignorance, the delusion, the utter lack of awareness of how bound we are, to our blind passions, how entangled we are in our delusions of separation, grasping, the grasping that comes from the delusion of separation, the endless craving. One last one here. Ordinary people are consumed by desire. Only the sages are able to consume desire. When you are consumed by desire, you lose yourself in delusion and pursue things. If you can consume desire, then nothing can turn you around. Thus the saying, if you can transform desires, you are the same as the Tathagatas. That is, to consume desire would mean seeing the nature of it, seeing that it is fundamentally nothing, seeing that all desire passes, and seeing this as one is confronted by desire. It's not that the sages, so-called, don't have desires, but they are not driven by them. The desires are there, one is not driven by them, just as thoughts are there, but one is not dominated by them. One sees them for what they are. Once ordinary people become involved in the realms of desire, all they know is the desired object. They do not know themselves. Only the sages are without desire amidst desire. Thus they can make the myriad things subtly wondrous without being entangled by them. He's talking about, of course, a state of deep enlightenment. Time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows.